Hello, and welcome to the Expanding Eyes podcast. We have been examining for some time Shakespearean comedy, in particular Shakespeare's festive comedy, so-called Twelfth Night, and today we're making the transition from the festive comedy Twelfth Night to a very different type of comedy that Shakespeare began writing in a moment of career transition in his mid-career, the so-called problem comedy, Measure for Measure. Both great comedies, but of dramatically, no pun intended, different types. Last week, we got through the plot, complex and rich as it is, of Twelfth Night, and it is extremely complex. A triple plot, three different plot lines all running at the same time, but all resolving themselves in the fifth act, which is one great big long scene, a recognition scene in the terms of Aristotle's Poetics, in which all is set right and we have our happy ending after many complications. And the audience is satisfied, and Fest sings, "We'll strive to please you every day." But as a teacher, I'm still not quite satisfied yet. I feel the need for us to step back and look at, are there possible larger thematic patterns that draw all of this complexity together into some common meaning? And this will take a little bit of remembering and memory jogging on our parts, but I'm hoping that we can do that. And for part of today, talk about, this was all a lot of fun, but is there really like a point to all of this? It's really very complicated. And obviously, I think there is. One way we can do this to step back and see, oversimplifying perhaps, but sometimes you have to oversimplify in order to see the pattern at all. We can say that of the three plots, it all involves a conflict between two opposite things that are in a kind of deadlocked relationship. The foreground plot, as always in a romantic comedy, is a, well, romance, except in this case, it's a kind of a non-romance, because we have Duke Orsino in Illyria, a non-existent country, full of non-existent feelings about romantic love, because Orsino thinks he's madly in love with Olivia, and Olivia thinks that she wants nothing to do with love or anything else because she is in some sort of artificial mourning, supposedly for 7 years, for her dead father and brother. And we have a complete canceled out deadlock of a romantic relationship, into which enters a third factor, a third character, our heroine Viola, who is washed up on the shores of Illyria out of a shipwreck at sea, disguises herself as a rather feminine-looking young man named Cesario, goes to work for Orsino, and before very long finds herself in a very complicated circumstance. On the one side, Orsino is clearly increasingly attracted to her, with, you don't have to be a 21st century major in queer studies to see that there is obvious homoerotic overtones to his attraction to so-called Cesario, because he's always walking around saying things like, "Oh, if you were only a woman." On the other side, Viola has gone, trying to be loyal to Orsino, to Olivia, trying to woo Olivia in Orsino's name, and succeeds instead in getting Olivia infatuated with him, that is, Cesario, not realizing that she's infatuated with another woman, or, if you want to be a little more depth psychological about it, who knows, maybe her unconscious knows very well What You Will. The subtitle of the play, What You Will, meaning what you bring about, but also in Elizabethan parlance, will meant what you desire. What do you desire? And people here clearly think they know what they desire, but another part of their mind maybe desires something else. So we have a deadlocked situation there with a third factor throwing it into chaos. The secondary plot in a Shakespearean comedy is normally the low-life satiric subplot, but here we have the theme of social overturn. The normal relations and laws of society are overturned during a period of festival or carnival, signified by the title Twelfth Night. And the festive characters who are celebrating away here actually have aristocratic titles. We have Sir Toby Belch, the aristocratic alcoholic. We have Sir Andrew Aguecheek. And the person who is trying to crack down on them and put order in things is Olivia's household student, Malvolio, whose name means ill will and who lives up to it, who is, in fact, middle-class climber on a power trip and trying to lord it over his betters. Then again, we have a third factor in the middle, you might say, with a split identity, the same pattern. We have the clown, Fest, who hangs out with Sir Toby's crowd of disruptors, but plays his own role and ends up in a curious but powerful scene, tormenting Malvolio. They contrive to have Malvolio declared mad, shut him up in a dark room, and Fest splits himself. He dons clerical robes and becomes Sir Topaz, a clerical figure who is going to cure Malvolio of his madness, because madness was held to be possession by evil spirits, hence the clerical stuff, but tormenting him, driving him almost mad for real instead, in a way that verges on not being very funny anymore. But he actually dresses up and talks to himself in two different voices, being two different characters. Malvolio in the dark cannot know this. Maria points out kind of the obvious. Why are you dressing up? He can't see you. He's in the dark. But the real point is, as we've said before, the dressing up is to signify it for the audience, that here is a character playing a split part, producing some sort of change and transformation. The third plot is the plot of, again, a split figure who happens to be Viola's twin brother, Sebastian, who has also survived the storm and shipwreck at sea, though Viola does not know this until the fifth act, and who comes into town in the false guise of Rodrigo, so another split character, and he is divided between two allegiances. He quickly acquires the love of Olivia, who thinks that she is still infatuated with Cesario. She thinks Sebastian is Cesario because the convention of the play, whether this would be plausible in real life is another question, but hey, it's a comedy, that they are identical twins, and when Viola dresses as a male, they cannot be told apart. So she thinks Sebastian is Cesario, and she comes on to him, and he's thinking, well, I think the people are all crazy here, but I kind of like the kind of crazy. I'm going to go with this. But he has a best male friend, Antonio, who is caught between male friendship and romantic love. And Antonio sacrifices himself, in a sense, for his friendship. He comes into town to aid Sebastian and gets himself arrested for it because he's a wanted man for sort of rigged up reasons in Illyria, but he does it for friendship's sake. So we have three plots with deadlock, signified by contrasting characters, and a third character in the middle, who is in every case in a disguise with two roles, often involving gender. That's clearly a pattern of some sort, whatever we are going to figure out that it may mean. We have that instance, and it is the third factor that destabilizes a sort of deadlocked binary relationship, but also by doing so, despite the chaos, enables a realignment and transformation to come about and a happy ending once again. In addition to those, this is a really complex play with so many networks of imagery and motif. But in the middle, the go-between in the middle, sometimes it's characters, but there are also go-between inanimate objects, strangely enough. There is the letter, for example. A letter is a go-between by its very definition. It is something sent by one person to another person. It goes between them, and it signifies something, but it has to be interpreted with possibilities for misinterpreting. And that, in the plot of the play, is the fake letter that Maria rigs up to deceive Malvolio, giving him fake instructions of how to behave in front of Olivia that in fact get him declared mad and shut up so they can torment him. This business of the necessity of interpreting something. And of course, characters who are dressed out of their normal gender roles are also being interpreted. It's a play about interpreting signs and signals, gender signs and signals, textual signs and signals, and the possibility of misinterpreting. In some banter with Viola, Fest, the clown speaks of himself as Olivia's corrupter of words, corrupting words, corrupting the words even of scripture to mean something that scripture should not mean. And this runs all through the play. There are also nonverbal signifiers, a ridiculous amount of jewelry going back and forth among characters, and jewels, rings, are also signifiers. An engagement or a wedding ring is not just an object, it's a message, and it sends a message from the one person who gives the ring to the other who receives it. And Olivia gives a jewel to Cesario. She gives later another jewel to Rodrigo, back and forth, back and forth. So this passage back and forth through the middle, and this is reflected in the plot of the play, period of festivity signified by the title, Twelfth Night. And in festivities, the normal order is relaxed and overturned. And there's a lot of chaos, but as I say, since this is a comedy, something will contrive that that chaos is creative rather than destructive. In Othello, for example, you also get a period of chaos, but it is destructive. And you have a character who is a middle character, Iago, who is not what he is, Shakespearean line, but he acts as a negative figure bringing about Othello's destruction. Here, all of this works to a creative and transformed end. In the end, gender and gender desires are straightened out, no pun intended, and people are lined up with the appropriate, at least in terms of the conventions, the appropriate spouses by the end. In terms of social order, Sir Toby's crowd is going to be cracked down on a little bit. And Malvolio has been humiliated and robbed of his power at the end. And Antonio is forgiven for the grudge that the Duke has against him. And Olivia hooks up with Sebastian instead of Cesario. And they all lived happily ever after, we think. The imagery, the most overriding imagery of the play, signifies this kind of threefold pattern. Start with a false situation that is deadlocked and characterized by what Blake called negations, false opposites that either cancel each other out or are simply in destructive conflict. That situation is overturned, a period of chaos, but out of that comes some sort of new and more desirable order. That's the threefold rhythm, and it is not just the rhythm of this comedy, but really of all the comedies. If you think of the other comedies that we have looked at, Midsummer Night's Dream and Much Ado, the same pattern appears there. We may add to that that the ordeal comes to focus on one character who goes through some ordeal indeed, and it's not always the same character in the triad. In the main plot here, the ordeal is that of Viola. Orsino's name means bear, and there is the imagery of bear baiting, the tormenting of bears that was some sort of not so healthy pastime in Elizabethan London. But it is Viola who is the one who is baited. At one point in the beginning of Act 5, everyone hates Viola, all for false reasons. She has done nothing wrong, but because of mistaken identities, everybody decides they're furious with her all at once. And she's gone through all of this for the very best and most loyal of motives, out of love and loyalty. In the second plot, it's Malvolio, the heavy, who undergoes the ordeal. And the best we can say is, well, he deserves some sort of ordeal. And in the third plot, it's the friend Antonio who goes through the ordeal. But somebody goes through a symbolic ordeal. But it's resolved. If we think of the other two comedies, Midsummer Night's Dream and Much Ado, we have the same pattern. We have a false situation in the beginning of Midsummer Night's Dream of paternal tyranny separating rightful lovers. They go out into the woods and all hell breaks loose, helped a lot by the fairies and the trickster Puck. And then at the end of it, everybody gets back together. The lovers are sorted out. The parent is overruled by Theseus. And we have the happy ending, the same threefold rhythm with the chaotic thing in the magical woods in the middle. In Much Ado About Nothing, there is no magical wood, but there is the feigned death and rebirth of Hero, the woman falsely accused of infidelity. They fake her death. Everybody gets remorseful about that. And it comes out to a happy ending in the end, in the third part of the rhythm. In Twelfth Night, there are two overriding archetypal symbols that symbolize this rhythm of basically a kind of death and rebirth. One is the sea itself. The sea is destructive. We think of Noah's flood. But we also think that it is out of the sea, out of the deep in Genesis 1, out of which creation first arose. And Shakespeare has a whole group of what are called by critics the sea comedies. His very first comedy, The Comedy of Errors, involves not just one set, but two sets of identical twins and a shipwreck at sea, and all of the attendant patterns thereof. And there are others as well, up all the way up through the last play fully by Shakespeare's hand, The Tempest, which involves, again, a castaway at sea and a new society emerging out of the sea, out of the water, out of destruction and the sea, is born something new. The other pattern that is another version of the same metaphorical pattern is the imagery of out of darkness comes light. The sun goes into the dark, but it always rises again the next day. One mythical motif was that the sun traveled under the earth, which was also sometimes portrayed in some myths as what was called the night sea journey. The sun would journey underneath the earth, but in the sea that is underneath the earth, and rise again out of the waters and out of the darkness in the east, sets in the west, returns to the east, and rises in the next day. Here we also have imagery of darkness and light, which is why, in a thematic way, Malvolio is tormented by darkness. They claim that it's really light and the darkness is all in his mind, but the motif of going through darkness to light, and the darkness is the darkness of madness. This play is very close in time to Hamlet, and it also has the theme of madness. When you doubt the ordinary rules of things, the false binaries of class and love and personal identity, they may be false and sterile and destructive, but at least they anchor things. It's an order, even if it's a bad order. But when that order is shaken, if it's shaken far enough, you may doubt your own sanity. That's a powerful theme in Hamlet, and in a comic modality, it's true here as well. Therefore, at the very furthest remove, the largest picture, we have this rhythm of a possible positive transformation, something that may involve a dark period, but out of which something good will come. What power brings this about is something that Shakespeare is remarkably cagey about, in my way of reading him, but he's always fascinated by that pattern, and he will remain fascinated by it, even in the period of the problem comedies to which we now turn. Measure for Measure is the third and greatest of a set of three plays that Shakespeare wrote in his middle period. Shakespeare made his first reputation writing two types of play, history plays and comedies, and we have been looking at those. But it so happens that as he moved in his artistic evolution, society was moving as well, and there's a lot of speculation of critics and biographers as to what the relationship might be between the two things. Shakespeare's personal psychology and artistic evolution, and the changes in Elizabethan society, which changed, in fact, from being Elizabethan society to being Jacobean in 1603. After a rule of 58 years, Elizabeth died in 1603, and James I came to the throne, and we are now in the Jacobean period of Jacobean drama. Why it's not Jamesian, don't ask. But it's the convention is this is the Jacobean period. And despite speculations about Shakespeare going through some depressive period, that may be true, but the fact is that it would be parallel to a darkening of the public mood. Jacobean drama, the very term to people who know literary history, signifies a darker type of play very often. Shakespeare's company also changed. It went from being under Elizabeth the Lord Chamberlain's men to being under James the King's men, which signified a new and much closer relationship with the royal court. And we happen to know As a matter of fact, that Measure for Measure was acted in front of James I on December 26, 1604. The period of 1599 to 1608, more or less, is Shakespeare's middle period, where instead of history plays, which now drop out of the picture all the way to the very late play Henry VIII, history plays disappear. They are replaced by the period of the so-called great tragedies, Hamlet, Lear, Macbeth, Othello, plus some set in the classical world like Antony and Cleopatra. And we still have comedies, but they are the problem comedies or problem plays. And there are three of these in a row. Troilus and Cressida, 1601-02. All's Well That Ends Well, 1602. Measure for Measure, 1603. So what's the problem, we ask? That is actually a 20th century designation. And it came from a situation in theatrical history at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, where the great force in European drama at that point, the end of the 19th century, was actually Scandinavian. The Scandinavian drama of particularly Ibsen. And Ibsen wrote what were designated as problem plays in two senses. First, they were actually about specific social problems in a very realistic way, each play examining a different social issue or problem. And second, they were problems in terms of being problematic according to, especially over in England, the London theater of the time did not know what to do with these plays and was not very happy about them, because by that point, the theater had devolved into genteel entertainment, a place where the upper class went in order basically to socialize. Half the time they weren't even paying attention to the play. They were talking to one another. And when they did pay attention to it, what they expected to see was some fluffy thing about who was going to get married to whom. What was called the well-made play, which basically means a kind of formula component part play. Very predictable, but giving the audience in a knee-jerk way what it thinks it wants. Ibsen, in his realism, upended all of that. And there were people in England who were trying to imitate the Ibsen pattern. And by far the most successful and talented of those was George Bernard Shaw. For example, early Shaw play, Mrs. Warren's Profession, is a play that, if you know it, comes to mind, I think, fairly easily when speaking of Measure for Measure. The problem in Miss Warren's Profession is, in fact, in the title. Mrs. Warren is a prostitute. But the plot of the play is that her daughter, who does not know this, discovers it as a grown young woman and is outraged and attacks her mother in a fit of arrogant self-righteousness, only to have her mother tell her that, why did I become a prostitute? Because it was the only way I had to give you your education and social station that you now enjoy. That's a problem play. And this got applied to these middle period comedies of Shakespeare, partly by Shaw himself. Shaw wrote a whole book on Ibsen, and Shaw was always criticizing Shakespeare for Shakespeare's supposed pandering to a popular audience. Shakespeare was criticized by that in his own time by people like Ben Jonson, and criticized for it by Shaw, who said that, well, these plays, play like Measure for Measure, it does have some serious social commentary in it, but it's also got this crowd-pleasing stuff. So Shakespeare was basically trying to have his cake and eat it too. Make the appearance of talking about real social problems, but eventually giving the audience what it wants. And so it's contaminated. In the English tradition, there was already, Shaw didn't necessarily have to go all the way to Scandinavia, there was already an English tradition of social drama, and that is the satiric social drama of Ben Jonson, Shakespeare's compatriot and friend. Jonson wrote at least two brilliant social comedies, Volpone and The Alchemist, and they should have satisfied any amount of high-mindedness about social problems and getting rid of all this phony romance formula stuff. And it was something that, in fact, was probably an influence on Shakespeare. It is quite probable, given what we know of the situation, that Shakespeare was trying to cash in, so to speak, on the popularity of the Jonsonian type of social satire play. Jonson's plays were put on by the so-called children's companies. This is a very odd situation where you have child actors, but acting this adult content, but so it was. This is alluded to as the war in the theater, war of the theaters, mentioned to some extent in a passage in Hamlet. But that was what was going on, that Shakespeare's company were trying to cash in on the appeal of some of this social drama. And yet, when you look at Measure for Measure, you see what happens, in fact, in All's Well That Ends Well also, that it's polarized. There is a newly realistic and sometimes rather harsh, ironic content, but it's polarized against motifs that come right out of myth and folklore. What is going on here? Is it as simple as Shaw's idea that Shakespeare was compromising, or is it deliberate? Next week, when we actually begin examining the plot of Measure for Measure, we see this set up in Act One. The source of Measure for Measure, Shakespeare almost never invented his own plots. Why do that when you can steal in an age without copyright? And he stole the plot of Measure for Measure from an author, an Italian author, that he had stolen from before, a man named Cinthio, from which he had also lifted the plot of Othello. And the plot is set in Vienna because of Cinthio, but also because of Cinthio, although it's supposed to be Vienna, because it's an Italian author that's the source, everybody has Italian-sounding names. It's what I joke in class about Spaghetti-O syndrome. All the males tend to have names that end in O, all the women tend to have names that end in A. So the opening setup of the plot of Measure for Measure is in Vienna. We have these Italian-sounding people. We have Duke Vincentio, the ruler of Vienna, who is leaving town. He is, in a sense, abdicating. It's supposed to be temporary, but he is giving up his authority and giving it over to somebody else. Well, he has to go out on this mission that he is very garbled and hush-hush about. It's clearly a pretext, and he's not really saying, but I must leave, and I'm going to therefore temporarily give over rule and power to this young man, Angelo, here, who shows such great promise. In doing so, the Duke, Vincentio, is passing over an older, qualified character named Aeschylus. And that's a rather mysterious and ill-advised thing to do, and we will see, as you can guess, just how ill-advised that is, because that does not go well. But he passes over the qualified older Aeschylus for the young, untried Angelo, and leaves town at least supposedly. We are within a couple of years here of King Lear, in which King Lear abdicates for real and gives his power over to his daughters, and that one, you may have heard, does not go well either. And we have one more parallel that I would throw in, though it may seem a rather arbitrary one at the moment, but perhaps not as we go further, and that is from a completely different type of source, the book of Job in the Bible, in which you could say God temporarily abdicates in the sense of giving his power over to Satan and allowing Satan to rule over and torment the very good man, Job, for very troubling reasons. In fact, the real question is, why are there reasons? And there will be exactly the same questions about the Duke in Measure for Measure. That's the opening setup in Vienna. And we will follow the way that shapes up next week.